All right. This is I speak in. I will say something in Hebrew first, Christopher, if I may, because it's you know what? I will speak in English immediately. So this is a podcast we called. I haven't told about this deal in America or in the U.S. Before, and it's a podcast where we talk about we try to inspire people on how to do deals in America. As a simple guy, because or women, it kind of there is a picture in our head when we start usually that you need to be born rich or born with a lot of money to do it. And eventually, I say that the inspiration is from the path you are going through, failure, success on the way. And I try to bring people to give the inspiration about it, and also not just inspiration, it's also about trying to teach people how to do real estate in the state. So this is an opportunity to talk with you, Christopher, Chris. May I call you Chris, right?
Yeah, both work.
All right, so Chris, we're going to talk today how to buy it. Finish lots and sell it to the builders and make profit, right? That's kind of the story. That's the episode today. So are you excited, Chris?
Yeah, because honestly, I think it's the best niche in real estate and yet no one really knows about it. So especially when you're starting out, but we'll get there.
All right. Good. So let's start, from the beginning. What did you do before you started real estate, or how did you hear about? Tell me, how everything started.
Yeah, the quick highlight of my journey is when I was young and working at a coffee shop, and I was trying to figure out the college thing, and I realized that I wasn't meant for, a kind of typical corporate career. I've always liked the idea of being an entrepreneur. So I started teaching myself video production and editing. So I was doing like a YouTube channel, just kind of like trying to grow that. And then because one of my regulars, he had his own production company, he needed an editor, showed him some of the stuff that I put together, and I became an editor. And then did that for a couple of years, got to work with Disney, Nike, Google, we did a lot of corporate stuff. But then part of that, I got to work for some major commercial real estate companies in the United States called JLL, Cushman & Wakefield. They have huge, they're the ones doing the high-rise structures and everything else like that, the big business parks, industrial parks. So we did a bunch of those productions, and that gave me the fire for real estate. I was really excited. I got to do COO and CFO, talk, middle management, just like see the opportunities that it brought in the corporate space. And so I realized I wanted to move into something that was much easier to diversify away. When someone wants your editing, they want you to edit. Like if Rafi edits something and I edit something, what it's going to look like is going to be completely different just because there's a million little choices. In real estate, you don't have that. Like a price is a price, marketing is marketing. It might be a little here and there, but ultimately it's money, right? It's going to go through escrow, go through a deal. And so I like that appeal. And I was talking with a buddy of mine who was trying to get out of his career, and he had been spending tens of thousands of dollars on seminars trying to figure out what asset class to get into, whether it's flipping houses or getting into apartments or trying to get right into development. Like he just looked into all kinds of things. And he settled after doing notes with his buddy that was going to be his partner that they were going to flip finished residential lots. It's because you don't have to deal with the three T's, the tenants, the termites, and oh my gosh, I don't even do it enough. So I don't even know what the three T's are. Or the tenants, termites, and toilets. That's what it is. So you don't have to deal with all the repairs.
Yeah. What was the third T you said?
Tenants, termites, and toilets. So you don't have to deal with like the upkeep of the building. You don't have to deal with like random things that you can't foresee, like termites. You don't have to deal with like, well, I don't want to move, or people squatting, or all that kind of stuff. You don't have to deal with any of that stuff. So with dirt, it's dirt. You don't need pictures of it. You can just use Google Maps. But again, we can get into all the benefits of it. So he sold me on it. And I was already kind of dabbling into trying to flip probate housing. So I don't know if they have probate in Israel, but basically when people pass away, if they don't have a trust, which is like a separate legal entity you can put assets into, you have to go through the court system and a judge has to do it. So it's this whole long process. And part of that is you have to settle the estate and sell things off. So anyways, getting to the point, trying to do that housing. work, getting called in an ambulance, got a couple deals, but nothing big. And my buddy sold me on that. So I borrowed a little bit more money. And I was, this is my last go. Sent some mailers out. Nothing was landing. My buddy and I sat down for like 4 hours to try to figure out where exactly I should send my last huge round of mail to go to. One last hurrah, fire, full broadside to try to make it happen. And we did like three different states. And luckily I had some stuff land in Florida. And I just got one deal and then two and then just kind of kept going. And now, you know, I've had big months. I've had, you know, small months. But, you know, it's been my go-to lifestyle for 8 years now, of just finding, you know, finished lots and flipping them to builders all over the country.
How many years are you doing it?
8 years. Yeah, 8 years is when I got my first deal.
Beautiful, beautiful. So tell me something before we jump on, you know, before we jump, I know I didn't prepare you for that, but before we jump on our process on how you do it, tell me maybe about the best deal you've done. Do you have any best deal that was really good? And then I'm going to ask you about a bad deal, but just to be prepared.
Well, I had one deal that I worked on and I scored $33,000 in one go and it took me about a week and a half. So it was a good deal. You know, the lady was happy to get the price that she got. She was excited. She thought she was getting it over the moon. And there were just some small details that I've learned in my experience that allowed it to not just be for one house, but two houses. And because of that, I was able to sell to a builder for more than what most people would look at the lot for. And we scored big. So everyone ended up being totally happy. The builder got to build two houses when he thought it was only going to have one until I found out the details of it. So it was really, really cool. And yeah, that was a big win for a week and a half of work to get $33,000. So
that's amazing. That's amazing. And what about, do you have something that didn't, that was a, like a deal that I say that you learn a lot, not just more from the deals you succeed, success, you have success from the deals that, you know, you fail, that you learn a lot, but then, because then you tweak everything.
Yeah, I was, you know, the first one that comes to mind is I was really excited for, I had gotten, there was a church that owned seven lots, all right next to each other, all flat, all buildable with all the utilities. And I was like, what? And it's in an up and coming area. Like it was a place that's being revitalized. Homes are going up like crazy. And I was like, this is going to be gangbusters. I'm going to nail seven lots. You know, I usually was trying to shoot for like, my average closing is about 10,000. So I was trying to price to get like 10, 15 a lot. I was like, this is going to be awesome. I could not get it moved for the life of me. I called all the builders I could. I was, you know, I was pounding the ground. I was calling real estate agents for all the local listings. And for like 2-3 months, I could not get it moved. And the reason, the same reason, everyone would tell me yes when they would look at it on Google Maps. The second they would go and visit it, right across the street was a historical cemetery from the Civil War. No one buried in that cemetery had been there or had died in like the last like 110 years. Like it was literally just a place to go visit people who had died during the Civil War in the United States. But builders were like, I don't think people are going to want to live across the street from a historical cemetery. Even though there was houses on that same street right there, people living in them, they just didn't want to do it. It blew my mind. So for me, that was one of the few times that it wasn't something about the lot per se, but just about like, I mean, there's always kind of an area thing, but like a specific thing where it's like, you can push as much as you want, but if there's like a logical belief, it was, I learned a lot about trying to sell and pitch and package. So, but yeah, that one fell through and I felt bad too, because the church was a small church and it, you know, I wanted them to have the money to do good. They did a lot of charitable stuff in that neighborhood. So, but I felt really bad that didn't work out.
Okay. All right. Nice. So let's try first, I think, to explain what is this niche? What are you doing? What do you mean by buying a finished lot and sell it to the builders? Why can't the builders will find it and sell? Something is missing in the title, right? So let's try to understand what it means. What is this strategy? What do you do?
Yeah. Yeah. In simple terms, there is raw land and then you get what's called the entitlement process. So whether it's one lot or it's, you know, hundreds of lots, you have to get the approval from the city, you know. And once you get that approval, it's buildable. And you can go and put a house on it or a commercial building, whatever it is. And what we're looking for, or what I'm looking for in my business, is for when there's a subdivision of homes, like an entire tract of homes, let's say, you know, 50 to 100 homes or whatever, that maybe were built out in the 70s or 80s. And, you know, about 9 in 10 of those lots have homes on them. and then 1 in 10 are just empty, unbuilt lots. And so they have taps to all the utilities and everything else like that. But for whatever reason, the owner never had the original builder build the house. And so I look to find those. So they are absolutely ready for somebody to go and tap the line, to go and build a house, to go and put a home on and sell it. And that's what's great. It takes all the headache away. It's already prepackaged. You don't have to get any approvals from the city. All they have to do is pull a building permit and your builder can go to town. And so it's what's called a spec home or speculative home. So not every builder does it. You know, a lot of builders want to just work, you know, they work in it because what they're doing is they're building for hoping they can sell it. So not every builder does it, but a lot of them do it because it's a great way to make cash. They can just build a home like they already do. And it's a smaller one and they can bet on the neighborhood and they can, you know, have solid comps and it's less risky, but it's still not like by order, right? So they're not having somebody who's already ordered the house. They have, so in that way, it's speculative.
Okay, so I didn't know that, but it's very, very, very smart. It's like looking for, you said you're looking for a neighborhood. You're looking for lots that are in the middle of a community that was built in the 70s or in the 80s or in the 90s, right?
Yeah, it could be anywhere. It could be a brand new one, just like if the person's ready to sell. But the whole point is it's ready to build. Whether it was built, you know, houses there built in 1910 or 2023, as long as there's an empty lot and it can build a house on it right away, you can grab it. Now, new ones are harder, but yeah, ultimately, it does, as long as it's ready to build, that's what we mean by finished lot. The lot is finished and it's ready for a house.
When we say finished, because people don't understand what it means that you just need to tap to the utilities and build a house, right? You don't need to do, you don't need to have roads. You don't need to build the roads. You don't have to build the connect utilities or build utilities lines. All right. So how do you find those deals in general? In general, how do you find those deals?
Yeah, honestly, it's not much different than what people do for houses. The difference is there's just a lot more houses. So I can look at an entire metro and there might be, you know, for a major metro, like 8 to 12,000 like vacant lots in any given city. And depending on your capital, you just go to one of the listing services and you put in the right criteria for the size of lots you're looking for and everything else like that. Maybe you draw on the map where you're looking to target and you just pull a list, you know. You can also go for free and you can go and pull it from the county usually. Usually records in the United States are usually, property records are usually held by county. So some counties make it really easy. My buddy of mine, he's still doing it. He's still doing land flipping and he just downloads it for free. From his primary county that he does, they have a whole database you can just have for free. So whereas I have to pull it for third party sources, just makes it a lot easier. So so it's not much different, but it just has so many other advantages of the property type it is compared to housing. So it's not too far off the process.
So when you do that, when you download, you said there are, can I filter it by vacant lots? How do you know the lots is finished and it's not like a raw land in nowhere? How can when I do that?
Yeah, typically what it is that there's a residential zoning, but it'll be like vacant lot residential. And so there's usually like a vacant residential zoning, whereas like if you have a finished home, it'll have like a single family resident or SFR zoning. Sometimes there's overlap. Again, every jurisdiction is different, but ultimately you can always categorize it by vacant lot and they'll be like vacant commercial. And also the other thing is I've learned don't put in agricultural because that's when you start getting into more rural lots. And most people who are doing land flipping, there are other people who do land flipping, but they're doing like rural agricultural stuff. They might divide it up. They might just look for like, you know, campsites that they can sell to people. And so like, this is just very different. You're looking in a city. You're like, you can look maybe in some outskirts, but for the most part, you're looking in established areas that already have homes because they prove the concept that you can build a home there. And so that's what you put into a listing service is you would map it on the map or in those areas that already have homes. And yeah, you would just go into like asset class and you almost every single service I've used, and I've used a lot of them, have vacant lot and then they'll have like residential, commercial, agricultural, whatever.
Okay, so when you pull the list, what kind of marketing do you do? Do you do like cold calling, when you have VAs that starting to do like in the wholesaling, a lot of them are using SMS campaigns. They use a lot of VAs that are doing cold calling. What are you doing in as a marketing? Do you do what kind of marketing?
Yeah, so for a long while, I did direct mail. That was great. And honestly, every marketing style has its pros and cons. But we basically switched over to all SMS texting, at least for our primary first contact outreach to people. And there's a lot of advantages to that. Main one that it was weird switching from going for mail is, you know, we didn't do first class mail. So our mail would take anywhere from a couple days to 2 weeks to get to people. And so there was this big delay. I would have to send it while I was still busy to hope to get leads to stay busy, right? And so there's this delay. And then the second I tried to start marketing, and also you forget it's texting. So people text you instantaneously. You can get answers back in minutes or hours from people. And also they say, oh, I'm already overwhelmed. Holy crap. So there's advantage to that. But what I found is I do a lot less qualifying the lead than probably other people do. I just want to know, are they interested in selling? Because and even if they're not, I'll put them on a drip campaign designed for people who aren't interested yet. You know, and I just put them on my system because I have a bunch of automation to automate all that stuff. And once they get in my system, we do ringless voicemail, we do email, we do text messaging. And then we've done cold calling. It's just very, I think it's great when deals are easy to get because it's very cost intensive, but it's very personal. So if you have somebody doing great cold calling, and I've done a lot of cold calling. I mean, I've done tens of thousands of cold calls. Sometimes I'll do that just through my database.
Do you do the cold calling by yourself, or are you doing it with a VA?
Nowadays, I don't do a lot of active cold calling just because our other marketing is so effective. But there's been times when I've done it in the past, and I've hired people. But most of the time, I've just done it myself just because it's helped me to kind of get back in touch with, like, the market more than I needed the deals. It was just, like, I wanted to hear what people were saying myself on things. And that kind of helps to keep in touch with, like, the market you're operating in, especially if it's a new market. Like, cold calling is a great way to understand what people are thinking. When you test tens or hundreds of people through cold calls, like, you can get a semblance of the different areas, the different regions of a city, what people are thinking. So it just gives you a very tangible way of doing it. But it's definitely not the most effective when it comes to cost, but it is certainly most effective for building relationships and things like that. So, yeah. Right. Anyways.
So when you talk, so let's say you do a drip campaign of text and somebody's calling you, he's calling you and you answer immediate. Do you need to be available all time, or there is kind of somebody's getting the calls and you call them back? How does it work?
Yeah, quite frankly. So I have basically the way that my system works is we text, we do a big mass text message, and then we have it to where if they do call, it gets captured and gets pushed to our CRM. That tracks it all. So I never lose a single phone call, but honestly, I don't take anything live. It goes right to our voicemail. And the reason for that is I've found that my conversations go best when I'm educated about the lot. A lot of people, like, and you can weed through a lot of, like, what we call tire kickers, people just testing to try to see, like, what it might be priced, but they're really not interested. You can weed that out really quickly in texting. And so it allows me to focus on stuff. Whereas what I like to do is figure out who's interested. It gets pushed to our CRM as needs to get due diligence. We do the due diligence to price it out, understand if we're even interested. If we're not interested, we just mark it as dead and move on.
How do you do that? You just give them the what kind of screening do you do by voicemail?
Yeah. Literally, most people end up just texting us back, and so what ends up happening is I usually the first thing I say is, hey, I see this lot at this address. Are you interested in selling in some sort of creative way? Just try to, like, you know, you got to get around SMS getting blocked, right? So you have all these creative templates to get around that and just get them to engage. And if they engage, in some sense, they're getting into my CRM. Because if I know that this person says, oh, I'm not interested in selling, I know I have the right phone number. So that's key. A lot of people just throw that away. I push it to my CRM because I'm going to track them for years and years and years until they tell me to stop, and then it's automatically blocked. But if they're going to let me message them, I'm going to keep hounding them until they finally one day are ready to sell. So that's my first qualifications. I just want to know, is this the right phone number for the owner of this property? Then if they say they're interested in selling, I'll just ask them, do you have a price in mind? Because sometimes if I know an area, like I can see on my texting service, I can see, you know, it's in this city, you know, in the larger metroplex, it's in this city. I kind of know, having been there long enough, what it's worth. and they go, oh, I want $300,000. I know that's only going to be worth like 60 or something like that. Then I'll push it and just say like, you know, to our CRM for a drip, you know, and honestly, half the time I don't even text them back. Like, it's just not worth the effort when they're just kind of delusional about what their property's worth, especially after COVID and the price is going up. But I'll push them and we'll just put them on delayed drip where we give them a couple months to cool off. And then we're going to text them again. We're going to email them and we text, email, and RVM them months later. And then it just on a drip to follow up until they're finally ready to come to their senses. But if they say something that seems relatively reasonable, maybe it makes sense. Then what I do is I say, hey, you know, we're going to look at the comps in the area and we'll send you an official offer. And then I just push to my CRM. It's marked as due diligence. And then we go and we value the property. So I do very little qualifying. I just want to know where they're at in their headspace more than anything. Is this somebody I'm going to waste time? Because I've wasted so much time thinking someone was interested in being reasonable and then they're not because I didn't do a good enough job. I just want to, are you even in the ballpark of sensible? And if you are, then I can determine what a property is worth pretty quickly. Nowadays, I could probably do it, I mean, gosh, in like minutes.
We will talk about it in a minute. But okay, so I want to get into something I'm curious about because in the houses business, right, when you do wholesaling, the motivated sellers are usually, right, they are tired landlords, right? Usually, but that's a lot of people are motivated because they've been in this business for a long time, they want to retire, or they've been doing it for so long and there is a lot of repairs, or they are, you know, old couple where their children moved out and the house is too big and they want to go downgrade the house, things like that, right? What motivation do you have in land? The taxes, property tax is not that high, right, on the land. So why does somebody will want to sell it in a low price? Do you buy it for a low price? What? So again, I'm trying to clear the how it works.
Yeah. So it is different, honestly. And for years, I was kind of taking what I think now is wrong advice because so much of what other people are doing is you have so many problems to overcome. You're really a problem solver as like kind of a house wholesaler. You're looking for all the objections to kind of overcome. With land, honestly, like it's really just kind of comes down to like the price most of the time, or just like the speed. Most people that you're dealing with probably inherited the land. You know, it's like their father, you know, their mom and dad bought it years ago, 30 years ago for $10,000. And you know, they just passed away a couple of years ago and they've just been paying taxes on, they haven't been thinking about it, you know, and you send them an offer for what seemed like a really good price. And, you know, they're thinking about retiring. So they just want to take that money and put it in their retirement fund, right? They'll get a nice big windfall. And so here's the other thing that's great. This is to emphasize this with housing. If someone lived in that house or it's their parents' house, there's nostalgia, there's emotion. There's like, oh, this was the first rental I ever bought. Right. And there's like this emotional, no one has that for dirt. No one has that for dirt. No one's like, oh, I went camping in the middle of a subdivision, you know, in Charlotte. It's like, it doesn't exist, right? So no one has this emotional attachment. There's no one to move out. So so that's one thing for a long time. People are like, you got to build rapport. You got to get on their good side. I'm polite. I'm kind. If people want to talk for a little bit, build rapport, always a good thing. Always a good thing. It's going to lock in your deal more. But a lot of the time, they just want to know what your number is. They just want to know, are you going to be someone who's going to jerk them around? You know, they just want to know that you're someone they can trust. That doesn't take long.
Let's say the seller asks for, you jump on a call. You don't need to ask them, when was the last time that the roof was changed and et cetera. Okay, we understand that. Mm-hmm. Why do you ask them? Like, okay, how did you came up with the number? Or you just gave him an offer? What? It sounds like if it's just a number, if he's asking 10,000 and for you worth, let's say, to buy it for 5,000, you're just going to offer them 5,000. That's it.
Yeah, honestly. So it depends on where in the process. Like if I'm on the phone, usually I've done my due diligence and I know what the property is worth. At least I have a pretty good idea, right? Sometimes there might be areas where it's really hot and I know that. And so I can be flexible. So I can know what the market typically would do and I can know what I can get away with. But let's just say, you know, if I'm dealing with somebody and I know I can sell it for 60, I'm going to want to try to offer 45 or 50. So I'm gonna try to make 10 to 15K. That's my usual benchmark of what my average deal is to make $10,000 to $15,000. And if ultimately come in, they're like, I'm at $80,000. I might ask the question like, well, how'd you get to that number? Like out of curiosity, you know, I'm looking at the comparables in the area and just homes aren't selling at a price that justify that for your lots. Like, I'm just curious, like how you got to that. Honestly, most of the time we're at that stage, it's 9 out of 10 times already a done deal. That person, it doesn't matter how they came up with that number. That's what they want. What most people get attached to emotionally when selling their land is the number in their mind because they're already thinking about what it can do for them. So, and it has nothing to do with what the house is actually worth or what homes will eventually be worth in the area. It doesn't matter. They just have a number in their head. So when you stumble across that person who's just like, you know, maybe they got like 20 grand in debt hanging over their head and they're like, oh, if I could get $25,000, I would be over the moon, you know, because the other thing, I could pay off my debt and go on vacation. Then you're looking, I can do it for 60. Sure, I can do that. You know, it's a bit of a stretch, but I'll do that for you. I really like you. And you go and send the contract off. And I've had people sign contracts without even contacting me. One lady sent me a scan of her passport and her driver's license and like all the death certificate of the guy who owned it because she was the wife. She sent it in the mail without even talking to me. Just take it. And we sold it in like 4 or 5 days, made like, I don't know, like 12 grand or something like on it, you know? It's just crazy. So it just depends. So for me, I just realized people are either really unattached or they're really overattached, but they're not attached to the physical building. They're attached to what they think selling it can do for them. And especially post COVID, there's a lot of that where people just got offered the moon and now you're trying to offer them, you know, what's sensible. And they're like, no, I want the whole, you know, the whole solar system, because they got offered the moon before. Now they just want way more than that. So I just move on. I just don't even care. It truly is more of a numbers game than a relationship game, I feel like. And again, that's an advantage because it allows you to scale quicker. You're not spending hours on a phone call or setting meetings, meeting people in person or whatever. You can just kind of be polite to people. But if they seem like they're in the realm of workability where you guys can work together, then you're off to the races and you kind of move on. It's not always the case, but I mean, I'm going to say 9 times out of 10. That's the case. You really can't convince people to take a lower price most of the time.
Okay, so the way you build your offer is looking at comps, what are the finished lots are sold in the area, right?
Somewhat so. So it's a combination of what finished lots are sold in the area for, what homes are being sold in the area for. Is there a trend to what the homes in the area are being sold for? Because ultimately builders, the cost of the lot, since you're going to sell it to a home builder, is a part of their math on them making profit once they of the cost of to build a home and making money. So you have to kind of think the way they think. And that takes time to just try to like talk to the different builders in your market. So you can go by the comps of what other lots are sold from the area, but sometimes they're private sale and it doesn't really matter. Like if they might be really low or really high, it just depends. Housing is a really good way to do that. But again, it depends on the price range. You know, it might be a much larger percentage of a small home's cost, whereas for a much, you know, once you start getting over like $500,000-$600,000, might be a much smaller percentage of the overall home's cost for like construction. So there's a little bit of bob and weave to it, but yeah, you're looking at comps and trying to dial it in.
We will talk in a minute how we find the builders, but when you talk with the builders, you will ask them how much they will pay for raw land, for finished lot. That's what you will ask them.
I would think that's good when you're first getting into a market, because every builder, every market's going to have different kind of understanding of their market, like what percentage makes sense for them, right? So, but the problem is too, is again, like, you know, any major city is going to have houses that are going to sell for 400,000, except for California where I live, which everything's $1 million, it seems like these days. But most places are going to have a variety of housing prices, you know, from 400,000 up to like $1 million+. So it's kind of hard to always ask a builder. Most of the time, what I would say when you're first talking with a builder, what you want to do is ask them, first up, do you build speculative homes? A lot of builders might build, they'll do custom homes by order. So they already have somebody who owns a lot and they'll build it on that lot that the person owns, right?
I don't want to confuse. So I need to I want to organize this again. So we jump for a second to talk about how to talk with the builders, because I want to know how much to offer.
Yeah.
An offer to the seller. So when you talk to a builder, You're saying they are building every, they might build everywhere, so they can't really tell you how much per finished lot, yeah. right? So yeah. you got to talk with them about, you said, how they said it's not a custom build houses because this is a fixed price, maybe that you pay them for how much. Yeah. But yeah. when, what do you call it, spec? How do you call it, spec houses?
It's called a spec, or SPEC. It's short for speculative, which means kind of like kind of guesswork. You're kind of just like, you're hoping, it's speculative. You're making a bet that this house will work off. And really, here's, let me categorize this. This will make it really easy. Builders do three things. At least, I mean, I assume this is worldwide, but let's just say in the United States. You have those that work on existing homes, right? So they might do an addition. They might, you know, renovate a kitchen or a bathroom or whatever, right? So they're doing, it could be structural or non-structural, right? But there's some, those ones you're not working with. We don't work on existing homes, right? There's the second one, which build custom homes. Custom homes are when they're working with a property owner who already owns land. Somebody who might already own an infill lot, or they just bought a 1-acre parcel outside of the city, and they're going to work. That person hired the builder to build them what may, you know, a custom home of some sort, and they're going to charge money for it, and that's how they'll make their spread. But the builder doesn't own the property, so for them, they don't. There's no speculation in building that home because they already have the land and the buyer of the home. They're being paid the money to do the home.
Yeah.
The third kind is a speculative home. And the reason why it's speculative is they don't have the home buyer yet. They are buying the land, funding the construction, and then putting it on the market, like as if it's any other home, as a new construction build, hoping to find the buyer for the house. So that's why it's speculative. A custom home already has a buyer. They're building a home in hopes of finding a buyer. And that's the one you're targeting. So the first thing I do to qualify a builder is to talk with them and say, do you do spec homes? And if they say, oh, no, we don't do that. We used to do it years ago, but, you know, I got tired of doing it, yada, yada, yada. Oh, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it. You know, I'm just hoping to do a spec home. All right, have a great one. Bye. First thing I say, do you do a spec home? Because if they do custom or remodel, it does not matter. I don't need those.
Okay, so when you get into a market, I'm trying to understand something. When you get into a market, you will start talking with builders first, or you find something and talk with builders? What do you do first?
First thing I do is I find a deal. I go, you know, we're doing that right now. We're expanding to other markets, you know, outside of our traditional market, trying to do different things. And I don't have an escrow company that's settled there yet. I don't have a buyer's list there yet, because what I care about is finding a deal. I know general, I've talked to hundreds, maybe thousands of builders now across the country. So I have the experience to kind of bob and weave going into just a market blind. But even still, I would say you probably want to find it first. There's some general formulas that you can usually go with to kind of get a decent idea about pricing. And then when you get to get down the road, then you just put in escrow, find your escrow company. And then once you're there, you can go on Facebook, you can go on Instagram, you can go on all the same groups. And those builders are in there. And then there's other ways that you can find them, building associations and everything else like that, but we can get into those details later.
Okay. So once you talk with them, you can understand how much you can pay for a specular houses in the area,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. Generally speaking. Yeah.
Okay, generally speaking. That with the comps for finished lots, you know, before the call, before you talk with the seller, you understand how much you need to, how much mm-hmm. your builder would pay for you, and you put between 10 to 15, right? 10 mm-hmm. to 15,000 spread, and you see yep. how much he's asking. If the numbers, if you see are at, I don't know, 20, I don't know, how much usually the house, the lots that you're working on are priced, around what, 50, 60?
I would say, 50 to like 80. If you get to 100,000, again, people know what their things are worth. There's like a sweet spot in there. If it's too cheap, then, you know, it's hard to build in a decent spread. So you might make 5, you know, because the whole property is only worth like 30 or 40 grand. It's really hard. But when you have more room to work with, you can squeeze in the 10 to 15, 20,000. But then you start getting into like, when someone owns a $150,000 lot, they usually know it's worth $150,000. Like, that's good money to them. And so they know what their asset's worth. When someone inherits a lot that's just like a standard home kind of goes there, that an average, you know, 3x2 house is going to go on, they might kind of know, they get the assessment letter from the county, but it's much more passive. They're much less likely to actually understand what the market says it's worth. So that's kind of the sweet spot. It's somewhere between like housing that's going for 250,000 to like, I would say top end, very top end, 750, 800,000. In between there, those are really good places usually.
Okay. So when you talk with the seller and you tell them, listen, I can offer you and give him a price, and do they have any, what do you do? Like, there is an objection, or you overcome the objection and just tell them, listen, now, when you want to, this is my number, talk to me if you want to sell. How do you approach the objection?
Yeah. I would say, again, practically speaking, I've tried thousands of times to try to convince sellers. Sometimes it works. More often than not, you know, I might ask them, like, how'd you come to that number? Or, you know, I'm just looking at what the market's saying right now. You know, this is what market price is. You know, you can go and ask a real estate agent. Like, I'll kind of call their bluff on what it might be. But truthfully, most of the time, or I'm, you know, if we're close, like, let's say we're $5,000 off and I'm trying to make 10, but if I took their price, I'd make 5. I'll push back and maybe I, you know, can get them to say, yeah, you know, hey, we're not that far off, you know, but this is what market price is. Okay, I'll take it. Sometimes I get 8, sometimes I get 7. Maybe I'll just take it and say 5 because I know I can flip it quickly.
But sometimes you can find out that the builder will pay more. So you got
exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And so, but at the same time, you know, if we're off by like 30,000, I mean, probably not. It's probably not going to happen. So more often than not, I might push back a little bit, but most of the time I just try to build rapport. I just want them to remember my company's name. I just want them to remember me. You know, that we have good rapport. So, hey, you know, I totally understand. We're just not at that price. But if you want in the future, please contact me. And then I'm just going to stick them on a drip and they're just going to be automatically followed up with later. You know, we might cold call them from time to time, but for the most part, you know, they're just going to be in my catalog of thousands of other people who are getting, whether it's monthly or quarterly, you know, text message emails and Rima's voicemails. So.
Okay. And I know there are questions in the chat right now. We will get to that, not to interfere
the flow.
Yeah. So, okay. So, and what kind of contract terms do you do with them? It's like, how much time for closing? I don't know. There is due diligence or study period, or what do you have there? How much deposit usually you do? Try to give us an insight about that.
Yeah. Here's another reason why, again, I just think that this is like easily the best niche in real estate, especially when you're starting out, is it's a one-page contract. It basically says, I'm going to purchase it and or assign. So I can always assign it to somebody. And I just lay out the basic details about the property. And one of the things is I get, it's subject to buyer's confirmation about property details. And it's super vague. And so I have to confirm my details that I like. And so, and then the other, so those, that's my first out clause, is I get to confirm property details. If there's something confirmed about it that I don't like, which could be anything, I don't like the fact that it has a tree on it, you know, I can cancel it. The other out that I have is all of my contracts are timed. So if I can't find a buyer or it ends up being a junk lot, I don't even have to cancel it. I can just wait for it to run out. So I never am obligated to have to purchase something. And then here's the other thing. I never put down earnest money. There's been a few times I've had what seemed like to be really good deals, and I've been tempted to put down earnest money. And every time, like, no, don't do it. Don't put down the earnest money. Don't risk the capital. And every single one of those times, they didn't work out. Every single time, it felt like it was necessary.
How is seller agreeing not for deposit? You don't offer that? They don't ask for that?
No, never offer it. If you don't mention it and you don't assume it, when I make my offer, I'll tell them a price. And as soon as they say yes to that price, I send them a contract. And I just say, get it back to me as soon as possible. Get in escrow. We'll get this thing closed up in about 2 to 3 weeks. And more often than not, they don't argue.
So usually you give them, you put in the contract for closing for 3 weeks, let's say 2 to 3 weeks. You're trying to find
my contract buyer. Technically doesn't even have a closing date set. It has like my standard contract, I think, is 6 months set out. So I have 6 months to be able to close on the property. Otherwise it becomes, the contract's null and void. So again, that's the language. You know, it's like, we're signing on this date, you know, and this date in the future, which is about usually 6 months in advance, you know, I have till that time to close. Otherwise the contract is null, void, and unenforceable. So it's literally just gives me time to buy, but I'm under no obligation to have to buy because it will just cancel itself. And there's been times I've offered earnest money, but then I push it as far as I can because I know I'm not going to deposit it. So I'll say, I'll give you earnest money, but there's so many things with this property that I got to look into first. You know, I want to talk with my builder, you know, you know, he's going to do all the construction. I want to make sure he's happy with it. And I'll set it for 2 or 3 weeks. If I can't find a builder in 2 or 3 weeks, I know it's garbage. And then I'll just cancel before the earnest money is due. So it's happened 10 times maybe in my entire career that it was such a good deal. It was worth the headache. And I was like, fine, I'll just put the term in, knowing that I wasn't going to ever put down the earnest money. I have literally never once put down earnest money or lost it because I never put it in. So it's less barrier to entry. You as a brand new wholesaler don't have to have the money to put up right away. You don't have to worry about it being locked up or potentially lost. And it's just less risk, it's less headache. And you can take that money that you were going to put up for earnest money and put it into more marketing.
How much do you think, let's say I'm just going to start doing it for now, how much do I need to put as a budget for marketing monthly? Mm. Let's say I'm starting, because there is a balance. There is a balance between starting, if you don't put enough money on marketing, right? If you don't put enough money on marketing, you might not get a deal. But if you, but at the same time, you haven't done a deal, so you don't have the confidence to put too much, right?
Yeah. So I would say, like, let me walk you through my thinking of this because I kind of feel like it's multifaceted. One is you got to think about what's your marketing channel. So, like, how are you doing marketing? Mail's expensive, but you know someone's going to open it, right? Text messaging, still kind of expensive depending on the services. At least when you're first starting out, a couple hundred dollars a month, like, that's not, you know, when you're first starting out and you're trying to, like, make some good money, like, that's kind of hard. Then you got to buy the list, you got to skip trace. That's another couple $100 just right there, depending on the volume of lead you're getting. So it really kind of depends on what marketing channel you're choosing. The cheapest one is cold calling. Pull a list, skip trace it, cold call, because you just do it in your free time. Ringless voicemail might also be a good choice because, again, you can kind of do it on the cheap. And it's something that deposits and you don't always get an immediate response back. They can just call like a free Google Voice number. I'm just trying to think practically for your listeners. So I'd say you really can be flexible because, you know, you might not need to get one this month. Maybe if you can just set a budget of a couple hundred dollars a month and you just, you know, you go, I'm going to do texting, or I'm going to do cold calling, or I'm going to do ringless voicemail, and you figure out how much that service is going to charge you, get an idea. I'm going to pull, you know, 500 leads a month, 1,000 leads a month. So you can flex your budget depending on the channel you choose, as well as how many leads you want to go for. Frankly, after COVID, you have to do more volume. Like you just have to just, there's so many more people who are deluded about what their price is worth. And that's market dependent too. Hence why I'm switching into other markets as well. My typical markets were booming. I crushed it during COVID. And now I'm having to be a little more flexible with where I'm going, where people didn't get, you know, bid up such crazy numbers. There's a lot more like reasonable people out there. And we're getting more deals done that way. But yeah, so it just depends. And I would say you can start with a small budget and just don't expect to get your first deal as soon as if you were able to hit it with a much bigger budget, you know? So you could get in for a couple hundred dollars a month, honestly. Just depends on which channel you choose and price it out and figure out what's best for you.
I think in my opinion, it's like, you know, as an investor, you invest what today? Maybe when you buy a house for rental, you invest 100 to get 7,000 yearly, right? So
yep.
Spread here is 10. I will spend 5,000 a month, I think, for sure, to get that. Yeah. Because I don't believe, and I know at the beginning I will throw money, but the more I have leads, I will learn more how to do it faster.
Yeah.
And very start fast. That's kind of my, you know, I remember when I did, you know, Dealmaker a long time ago when I started, I didn't put a lot of money on marketing. It was hard for me to get to people, right? Yeah. So the minute I started to do more advertising, I kind of got better and passing my message to people.
Yeah.
Right. So it's kind of the same. People try to, you know, not to be cheap, but they don't want to lose money. So they say, oh, we start small. But because you start small, you don't get enough leads to practice. Mm-hmm. And then,
yeah.
So
I 100% agree. Like if I can just add to that, like the key, I think, if anyone's starting out, because this is what, luckily I was smart enough to think this way when I first started, is get your first deal to fund the next stuff. A lot of people get their first deal and they start spending it on like their groceries and going out and everything. Like I did one nice meal with my wife just to prove that we were making money. The first deal, I was like, look, babe. She's like, you sure we can be at this nice restaurant? I'm like, yes, you can absolutely afford this now. But besides that, like I rolled it into more marketing, because at the end of the day, it's kind of, especially nowadays, it's just brute force the more you do. So you can get started on a small budget, but be consistent. So you will get that first one, and then you can kind of dial it up. So it's smart to be cost effective, but you just need to keep going. If you spend money and don't find a deal and just stop, then yeah, you truly just wasted that money. But if you can learn through the process and get a deal 2, 3, 4 months in, and then that ends up becoming your new budget. You know, my first deal, I made $6,000. I used that $6,000 and I got two more deals out of it. So you really just need to, like, if you can be consistent, even on a small budget, to get that first win and then use that as your new budget, you can kind of ramp it up. Now you can do, instead of 500 leads, you can do 1,000 a month or whatever, right? Depending on your channel. And you can just go from there, and then you get two or three more wins and you kind of go from there. But it really is just volume. Like at some point, it's just brute force. It's not about sophistication. It's not about like building rapport. It's just like sometimes just the next breakthrough is just doing 10,000 leads a month, you know, and then as soon as that starts landing, you're doing 15 and 20,000. Like it's just about hammering it. And that's how companies get big.
Okay. So I like it. I'm trying to think. So we were at we were under contract. You expand the contract. You have 6 months, which is amazing enough time. You never gonna get it on a house. And then
I got it for a year once. Actually, for a long time, that was my standard contract, was a year.
That's crazy.
That's crazy.
And then when you and then you reach out to builders, how do you find the builders? You kind of say to Facebook or what? Where do you download the?
I would say the easiest way is probably where you're going to find the normal stuff is where you can go to like Facebook, Instagram, all those sorts of groups. Try to get them to sign up on your landing page. You know, if you can scrape emails off of Facebook, that works too. I mean, I've done all these different things over the years, just finding different groups and finding other vacant land that was being sold on there. And, you know, somebody dropped their email and I reached out to them directly myself. Like I just, you know, a lot of it's just manual work, but some of the creative things that I've done, here's a little pro tip. This is worth time stamping for yourself. Redfin is an American listing service like Zillow, but their key difference is that they purchase access to the local multiple listing service where all the agents actually list. So all the listings on their site are actually listed through agents. And one of the key things about that is when you go to any of the comps in the area. So what I'll do, let's say I find a lot in an area, I will look for new construction homes sold in the last 6 months, last year in that neighborhood or surrounding mileage. And what I can do is I can see the agent that listed it. And what happens is a lot of these builders, they list their new construction speculative home on the market. And so I can call that agent and say, hey, I saw that you sold a home, a new construction home. Do you have a builder who might be interested in this area? And so I'm not talking to the builder, but I'm talking to the agent that knows the builder. And a lot of times these builders that are doing 30, 40, 50, 100 homes in a city use the same one or two agents that do all of their listings. So now you have this agent who every single time you get a deal, you say, hey, I got this over here. Would your builder be interested? So sometimes not always direct contact. You know, you might have to throw the agent a fee, or maybe they're cool just taking only the builder's fee. So that's a really good nugget to find builders indirectly, but you can do it without having to pay to get access to the multiple listing service. You just use Redfin, who pays for access to the multiple listing service.
Okay. That's a cool approach. I never thought about it. That's good. And so now when the builder is interested, right, do you wholesale it to him, or do you do like a double closing? You buy it and you do a double closing.
Yeah, there's two key ways you can do it. You can do what's called an assignment of contract, where I don't know if you're familiar with it, but you're signing your rights to the contract, like your position in that contract to the builder. The advantage of that is you don't pay closing costs. The disadvantage of that is the builder knows how much you're making, because they're ultimately paying you a fee to be able to take over your position. I have done 99% of my deals as a double close. 1% of my deals is an assignment. Because more often than not, I think builders are comfortable with something like $5,000 to $8,000, you know, as a fee. If I usually do 10 to 15 on my average deal, and I haven't pushed it, I just don't think they're going to want me to make a five-figure take. I think they're going to want to squeeze me later on. So I do what's called a double close. And I don't know if you guys know what that is, but ultimately I'm using my buyer's money. I have two different escrows. My buyer's money is being used to pay my seller. So if they're buying it for 60 and I'm buying it, the land from my seller for 40, they're taking 40,000 of that 60 to pay my seller. They're reducing the escrow cost. Let's call it $1,500. And I'm going to make the 20,000 minus the 1500. So 1850, for that property. And my seller thinks I'm the buyer, because I am legally on the contract for like a minute or two when they record it with the county. I am the buyer. And my buyer, my builder, thinks I'm the seller. They know I'm wholesaling it, but contractually I'm the seller. So I'm signing a deed to them for the property. And so it's all this transaction, but it all happens in a matter of moments. And the reason why that's advantageous for me is it hides how much I make. You know, there's no way my builder is going to want me to make $33,000 on a lot. So I hide it from them. Even if we're good buds, I just doubt they're going to want me to make that kind of a killing. So I hide it all, you know.
Amazing. I like you. I like the way you did it. Do you do like a seller financing with land or with builder? It's not going to work.
Honestly, like, so that's something I've always kind of wanted to play with more. My buddy has done a lot more of it. So here's how they've done it. Here's just like the highlight of how we did, without getting too much into the details, is you can offer the seller to buy it on seller financing. So you're going to want to get as low as possible and, you know, on price and interest and everything else like that. And then I have a couple of these deals myself, and this is why it's a little less advantageous. You're not usually selling it to a builder. You can, but not usually. I would sell that lot on like a Facebook marketplace or something. And I have a couple of lots that I sold like this where I then sold it for somebody else to build their dream home on it. And I sold it to them as seller financing. And so the reason how I make my money is that some of my lots I got between $3,000 and $4,000. There was some floodplain involved, so it made it difficult. So the guy wanted to get rid of them. I was able to know that we could work with it. So I bought it for $3,000 or $4,000 of three different lots and on a super low interest rate. And then I sold it for, I think the lowest one was 15, the most expensive one was 20,000 at like 14.9% interest, because 15% and I break the usury law. So I just sold it for as much as I could on a 30-year mortgage. And then the difference is now is I can use that payment to pay, you know, if this is a $100 payment, but I'm making 450, I can take the $100 from the 450, pay them off, and I make the 350 in the middle. So there's different ways you can do it in there. You can choose, like you can sandwich it. You can use investor money to buy it. If you can get it cheap enough, you can use some investor money to buy the property and then create a mortgage note. Excuse me. But that's how you can do it. You can, but I don't do it enough. My buddy's done it, and he does it enough to where he pays for his mortgage with it. You know, he pays for most of his daily living just on these drips, just coming in.
Amazing. Amazing. Bless you, man. So, yeah, that's what happens when you talk a lot. Get used to it. Listen, that's a, I really like this strategy, the way you do it. It sounds not simple. It's not simple. It's easy to do, but it's simple, but it's not complicated where you have tenants and all of that. But it's very logical.
I want to. When was the last time someone sold you a house sight unseen without you talking to them? It doesn't happen all the time, but it happens often enough over the years where I've had people sign a contract and I never talk to them. I literally have the escrow company set the closing date with them, and they'll send them a mobile notary to come to their house. They never saw my face, never heard my voice, and yet I made $15,000 on the property. Again, nowadays it doesn't happen as often. Still happens, just not as often. But that just doesn't happen. So when you talk about simplicity, that's only possible because of the simplicity of it. And that's why I think it's just easily one of the best niches to get into. There's just less moving parts, less heartache, less headache, you know, less concerns, less upfront capital. It's just the best, in my opinion. That's why I still love it.
All right. Before we wrap everything up, there are some questions people ask, so I want to refer that. What is the place what is your place in the chain value, and what is your added value? Ilan, I think we answered that. I don't know. Maybe you ask it again. Merav asked a question in Hebrew. What about the spam law? How do you handle that when you send text?
I use Scrubs for do not call list. And then if somebody says, I hate you, don't contact me, you know, cussing at me, whatever, they have a little button. I just mark it as do not call, and it takes them off the list. Actually, I believe it adds it to their list. So in the future, other people won't reach out to them as well. So that's really helpful. Also, the skip tracing service I use, you can pay to do a DNC scrub since my listing service or my texting service already does it. I don't pay for it, but it will do that.
Yeah, do not call.
So it'll automatically scrub. Or it'll mark it. So if I didn't use that texting service, and maybe I was doing like cold calling and stuff, you could still skip trace it, and then it'll have a little yes, no, at least on the skip tracing service I use, which is called Direct Skip. You can pay extra for it. And then you could just sort it in your spreadsheet and then just delete all the ones that say do not call yes, and just delete them, you know, and there you go. So that's how I would handle the scrub list. I don't even think about it anymore because it's all automatic.
Is there anything on your text or the message you, an overall message that they get it and they don't see you as a spammer? It's like, do you say, because wholesalers usually what they say, are you interested in selling your house? This is the sentence that I don't know now, but I remember in 2015-2017, that's what most wholesaler was using, right? We buy cash, or the same language over and over. Everybody was using the same language. Do you have your own language on your text that you built?
You know, I would say I don't really beat around the bush. You know, every time I've done text messaging things that say that, I don't get as good of a response rate. And I feel like that more than anything feels cheap. There's certain, again, the service that I use, they have keywords that they don't even allow you to text out, so you don't get caught by, you know, the carriers. Carriers know what they're doing, but they, you know, they don't want you to get caught by the spam filter since you're legitimate. These spam things, just so you know, for clarity, are mostly about, they don't want people to get defrauded. If you're genuinely marketing, the carriers don't want you to bother people a bunch, but they want you to be able to reach. They want you to use their network. So that's why for them, it's like keywords. They look at what fraudulent people are doing. They try to keep those keywords out. But for the most part, I'm pretty much just asked directly because there's just not as much stuff to it. So.
Okay. Let's see what else. Do you send blind offers?
I used to. That's my primary way of doing mail back in the day, was sending blind offers. And there's magic to that. Like that's when you get into like calculating formulas on like how to do blind offers. Might want to do it based on market price. You might want to do it based on assessed value. You kind of have to like do a deep dive study on like your market and like the county you're operating in. And counties usually do assessments. Like, are they even remotely accurate? You know, some counties used to be really accurate on their assessed price, and then COVID hit and prices went up and they way over assessed values, way above market pricing. And so now it's just trash. So it just depends. You can definitely do blind offers, but nowadays I do texting as my primary mode of initial outreach, so I don't have to do it. Now what I want to do is just basic qualification, bring them into my system. I do my own kind of offer. If it makes sense for what they might have said, or, you know, then I go and make the offer. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And then I just move on to the next one. It's a real numbers game for me nowadays.
Akiva, I didn't understand the question, but I will say that. Akiva asked, what about the price of $1.8 million for 2.77 acres? What does that mean? Someone has already made the money on this land.
Let's see. Okay, just without knowing anything about the market, the area, I'm going to say $1.8 million on 2.77. Okay, I see it there.
Probably multifamily or commercial.
Yeah, I'm gonna lie. Like, that sounds expensive. Like, I mean, I could see again, Southern California, super expensive market. If you were on some sort of hillside, again, you got to look at all the different factors that go into it. What are homes selling for in the area? What is it zoned as? That's another advantage of doing this sort of wholesaling, is you end up learning the base stuff of what makes resident real estate possible. You'll learn zoning, you can get into code, you can get into the little nitty gritty of stuff. And so that's something that, like, just looking at it, I would say that only makes sense is if it's zoned for the right thing. And it's like, if it's residential, it's like a hilltop area in a really, really upscale area. And the homes around the area are going for like $5, $6, $7 million or more. Maybe it's a private gated community. If that's just for someone to build a subdivision, move on. That's a waste of your time. I cannot imagine you can justify that for not even 3 acres.
Yeah. Do you say when you talk with a seller, do you tell them that you are going to sell it to somebody else? I believe. No.
I use phrases like, I need to talk with my builder. So I kind of like, I allude to it, but ultimately they say, well, what are you looking to do with the lot? We're going to build a house on it. Because ultimately that's the case. So I don't personally feel in my own moral conviction that I'm lying about it. And I'm going to go turn around and tell the builder's going to build a house on it. I say, we're looking to buy a lot so we can go build a house on it. My builder is going to go build a house and we're going to, sell it and we're going to have a family move into it. All of which is true. I'm just not a part of the actual process of doing it. So that's how I usually reflect that.
Good. I like it. Where do you advertise and in what platform? Barbara, I didn't understand. What do you mean advertise for what? Ask the question again. Okay, Maya, we already answered for that. We can get you a contract now on the podcast. Question: how do you find builders? We answer. How many employees VA has in your business? How many employees do you have in your business?
Yeah, currently, honestly, I don't have any because I've automated so much of it. I had one, and she was doing a lot of cold calling, and we're trying to do some more development stuff. And so she was doing a lot of like qualifying. But we've kind of just moved into a different direction. Some of the services I use just kind of automate to where I want to do some more stuff with AI to where I can get more personalized stuff. But all my follow-up stuff is pre-recorded and automated. So I literally every month I'm sending out thousands of text messages, emails, and ringless voicemails all just through a system that I use. That's all automated and I've planned it out. So I just don't need to do that. My texting, I do most of due diligence. I do all the due diligence myself nowadays because I can do it quickly. Whenever I've hired a VA before, they always kind of either got the wrong price even after training them for weeks, or they just took forever to do it when I can do it in just 3 minutes. So that's most of the time. And again, that's why for me, it's about turn and burn. I could definitely bring somebody on, but with where we're at in the market, I'm expanding to new markets. I'm happy with where I'm at. I'm going to keep expanding, but we do thousands of outreaches a month. So I'm not concerned about having other people on if I can do it more efficiently by myself.
Okay. Barad asked about where do you advertise for the builders to sell it? So you said on Facebook, right?
Facebook. Facebook. I have my own email list that built up over the years. I'll give you another little nugget that's kind of good. Sometimes you can go to builders associations. Some of them hide their membership, other ones don't. So there might be multiple builders associations in the market that you're in. You can sometimes find their membership and then, they might have their contact information there. Again, it depends on the association, just how much they reveal, but that's another way that you can find it. So in the beginning, you're going to do it a lot more manually. You're going to do a lot more outreach. You're going to build that list up. But once you have a list, you might even find, one guy who wants to take up most of your stuff, two, three, four guys that'll buy 90% of the inventory you bring in anyway. So it just depends. But yeah, that's if I ever have to do stuff, it's pretty rarely on Facebook nowadays, usually just my marketing list or people that I know. I just make phone calls to them and say, hey, I got this lot before I blast it out. Do you have interest? That's usually how it goes nowadays because I'm established enough.
Okay. Kamel asks, the lot is a percentage of the home buildings in Israel. Is it about 30%? How much is it in the state? Meaning, how do you get the calculation, how much a finished lot from the houses being sold?
Yeah, high-end homes, again, we're approaching million plus, probably going to be closer to 10-ish%, 10-15%. And then for like, on the low end home, like a $200,000 home, $150,000 home, which again is really skinny, it's gonna be hard to make the money there, but you make something. Probably the final lot price would be worth maybe 30-35% just because it's going to take up more of a smaller number. But it just varies. So, and again, each market's different too. So Southern California's percentage is different, but that's generally, I would say, is a range of like 15 to 30, somewhere in there, depending on the price point in the exact market.
There is two ways I like. One is to ask the builders to see how much is being sold and ask them. Second is to make a calculation how much will be the cost to build a house, put their margin in it. They want about 20-25%, right, of a margin, from 15 to 25, usually 20-25% of the margin, and then you have, that's when you have the finished lot.
And the margin's different. Like if it's an expensive home, they can make a smaller percentage because it's of a bigger number, right? Like we all understand the math on that. So, and that's the same thing that goes down. It's like you're going to have if it's a cheaper home, it's going to cost more of a smaller number because it's just proportional.
Ori asks, how do you know if the lot is buildable? Is it only after the potential seller contact you back?
First thing I qualify for is this the right person? Because I'm skip tracing, but you don't always get the right number. So is this the right contact information? If it is, are they interested in selling? If I know it's the right person, they get in the CRM. If they're interested in selling, then I'll ask them for their price. And then I go and do my due diligence. One of the advantages of this is, again, if you're not doing rural, which is like 95% of people doing land, they're doing stuff out in the sticks, you know, they're doing rural stuff. Whereas I'm building stuff, you know, where we'd all live, like right on our street. What's great is if there's homes on either side of the lot, 99% of the time it's a buildable lot. Not always, there are caveats to that, but I mean, you could probably take it to the bank. A lot of times I just assume it is. I just look at it and I just mark yes or water, yes or sewer. I can see the electrical pole when I look at Google Maps. If you really want to double check it, sometimes you can go to the county and you can get in, or the municipality, and go and look at it. But sometimes you can just like look around Google Maps. Do you see an electrical box? Do you see like the little manhole covers that say sewer and water on it? Like you can kind of tell these things. Do you see a water meter already on the property? So sometimes you can just do it without making phone calls and like waiting on hold for the right person. But generally speaking, the houses around it are already a very good clue that it's buildable. And does it look flat? If it's like a gigantic slope, then like the chances are no. You know, a lot of it's just common sense.
Yeah, and you will get the feedback from the builders anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've had times when everything I checked out, it said it was buildable, and then they said, "Oh no!" Like I went, they had a guy who, some municipalities won't actually show you a map of where the sewer and water lines run. They'll just say yes or no. And my lady had said yes. And then he's like, no, I have a guy. He sent me the map because he's been working with them enough that he just emails him directly. They send him a snippet of the map and it runs right up to the neighbors, like a house away. So it was just barely in front of the neighboring house. So they would have to run it up the street, like of a pretty decent frontage, and then bring it in. And when he did the calculations on it, it didn't matter because the municipality is charging too much money to run it. So yes, kind of, but not for the cost effectiveness. So, you know, sometimes you run into that and it is what it is. And truthfully, and this is going to sound bad, but truthfully, there have been times when I didn't know a lot was unbuildable until after the person had bought it. And they said, hey, and I'm like, look, I'll send you all my research. I'll tell you who I talked to at the city. But, you know, at the end of the day, you bought it for what it is. Like you have your, you know, it's also your job to, so to a certain extent, you want to know it's buildable because it makes it a better product. But at the end of the day too, it's also your buyer's job to actually confirm those details. And if you sold it to them and you made your money and it's like, okay, well, like, I don't know what to tell you. Like we all did our best. And, you know, so I've had a few times that that's happened too.
Okay. Before I answer more questions, if somebody wants to ask, you know, reach out to you, ask you some questions, you know, consulting you, maybe, I don't know, ask you and help him. Is there any way you can reach out to you?
Yeah, that would probably just be through my email, which is Chris, that's CHRIS at US.
Okay, let me email. Yeah. It's a USR-RI, right? That's the email.
Yeah, US-RI.com. So not an underscore, but the one that's in the center. Yep, exactly.
Okay.
This, US-RI.com.
And if they want to reach out to you over WhatsApp and send you a text, I know you have WhatsApp. So what is your WhatsApp? Can I give them that as well?
Yeah. If you have it, I don't even know where to look for it. I'm new to WhatsApp ever since we started hanging out. you know, start chatting.
Okay, I have it on the hair and I will type people.
Everyone else is on the WhatsApp train way before me, so.
Yeah. So they can reach out to you on this or to ask more questions, because this episode going to go on YouTube, and people will have it under the chapter, in the episode, and they can reach out to you and ask questions. I know there are people asking more questions, so I want to ask another, maybe two. How do you explain that builders? Okay, how do you explain that builders didn't find this lot? Meaning, why you found this lot and the builder didn't?
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of builders. So is Ordie Cullen. A lot of builders. Not yet. Okay,
let's hold on.
Let me finish the presentation. Let's hang out first. A lot of builders, they do things that are already on market. So the same reason why, you know, the homes you get when you wholesale them, you know, if they were listed, everyone would know about them, but you're marketing to off market homes. The same thing. You know, again, a lot of these people, you know, sometimes a lot of people there's loans on the property because it's mowed, they don't pay the taxes on them, and they're just kind of like sitting there. And I've had people who they were pretty broke and destitute, and they didn't even realize they owned the darn thing. But I happened to reach out to them, and I confirmed it all with them. Like, we signed a contract, they produced all the legal documents they needed to. And next thing you know, all of a sudden they had a $40,000 windfall for them. So some people just don't know it. They're just way less attached to it, and it's not on the market. So most builders are just looking on the market. They don't want to haggle. They don't want to look for it. And so that's where you come in. Like, someone asked earlier about where I'm at in the value-added chain. I'm not actually adding value to the property. I'm adding value by connecting the property with somebody who wants to add value to it. That's ultimately where it's at.
Okay. All right. That's good. That's actually good. You're helping the builders having more product, more lots for their products. That's kind of what, because they don't do direct mailing and taxes. They get.
It's a whole game. When you've been in it long enough, it seems, oh, it's so natural, it's so whatever, like everyone's teaching how to do this. But like, you got to realize, like, these guys are putting on a tool belt every day. Most of these guys are small home builders. They might do a couple homes a year. They have a small crew or two, you know, and they're busy going around on trucks, moving dirt, you know, negotiating contracts. They're not thinking.
And they're getting calls all the time anyways.
Yeah. There's already people marketing them saying, hey, buy this lot, you know, over here. And they're looking at it in their email every day. So why would they want to go search for it themselves? You know, they're perfectly happy just picking it up from somebody like us and doing it.
Yeah. And Anonymous has asked him, I'm still surprised by the length of time for closing. Why should a landowner accept the length of time? Because they own it for so many times, so many years. They don't care if it's a month, two, or usually again, they are not motivated. It's not the motivation. Again, it's about the price.
That's a key is. And it took me way too long to realize it, because then I spent way too long trying to convince people that I'm like their savior and I can pick them. They don't care. Most of the time, they don't care. I mean, sometimes people are genuinely happy, right? Because I'm able to find a solution. But most of the time, it's a build ready lot and it's ready to go. I'd say that most deals I can close in weeks. I want as much time as possible, because I'll give you an example. There's one lot that I'm so glad we had 6 months, because there was a title issue. The guy selling it and his family, who we needed three signatures to sign off on it, because it was something that was inherited, which can happen. The mother that all of the people who inherited it from had been married four times. And so we had to figure out when she was married in all those different times and see, like, and then did they die? What happened to all these guys? So we had to get what's called an affidavit of heirship and get it all figured out. At one point, I had to go down. Luckily, I live in Southern California, even though I do all my stuff in other states. I had to go to the LA County Records Archive. I went into their deep down basement where they have all the hard physical records of all the marriages and divorces. And I had to search, because at one point, this lady had lived in California, luckily LA County, and got married and divorced. Well, come to find out, after doing all this digging, they never got married. So, and this was the dad, mom and dad of my seller, of the key seller, the guy I'm in contact with. I'm not telling him that. Your mom and dad never got married, so there's never a divorce. Now, luckily, it was great for our title stuff, But it took months to track down all the other information. We had to go and hire people and figure out, right? It wasn't like some PI that was all expensive, but you know, we got ancestry.com and we got creative. So there is sometimes this problem solving, getting creative, but I had to physically like wait for a month to get into the archives to double check it, and then found out something awkward, but it was perfect because now we could just cross them off the list of the affidavit ownership and then get all the signatures and we moved on. And so in those cases, that's why I still leave it at 6 months when most of my stuff, like 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month. You know, sometimes my builder wants a survey where they go and look at the lot and they look at the topography and where the boundaries and everything. So sometimes that can take a while, especially when things were hot in COVID. You know, surveyors might be 3 weeks, 4 weeks out. So you want to have buffer room, but for the most part, it gets done in 2-3 weeks. And most sellers, again, they're just not as attached to the land. So you can get away with asking for more time.
All right. Good. I know there are more questions, so they're going to reach out to you because the episode is very long. you have gave the audience so much content. I think I don't remember how much content we gave in one episode this way. Really drained out a lot. That was amazing, and I really like your strategy. And I like that people can do that, and I encourage people, audience, to try and do that. No, I don't say to try, is to go and do that. The way I told people, Airbnb is a way to do it. There are so many strategies. Everybody needs to find something that they feel that they connect to it or are excited about, and go and do it. And I think it's a good niche to be in.
I genuinely believe that too. Like wholeheartedly, I think that this is, I'm glad my buddy convinced me of it years ago, obviously, just because it is the easiest one for me to get into. It's kind of foundational because you start to understand like classification of different assets. You don't have to borrow money usually unless you're using it for seed money to get started. And there's just way less moving parts, way less people who are concerned, way less emotional things to get over, you know, for sellers and builders. Like you want institutional buyers. That's what's great about selling to builders versus like most people flipping land or just trying to flip it on like Craigslist or Facebook to like consumers and stuff like that. Like, and that's just a whole different breed. I used to try to do that, and I realized that wasn't until I started targeting builders, and that just made a system to my business. So there's just so many advantages to this niche. You have to be in love with the idea of it. It has its pros and cons. If you really love the idea of owning a piece of, you know, an apartment complex, like that has its own appeal and attractiveness, and it's got its own way of working. But like for just cash and getting in and understanding and learning, like for me, this is like, I honestly don't know if I could tell somebody to go for houses versus doing this personally, just because I'm so exposed to this. It's my world. And like, you know, you just got to put in the effort. It is still a business. It is still work, but man, it's just so many less headaches than I hear other people deal with. I've sold one house in my entire time because it had two lots next door to it, and I wanted the lot, and they insisted on selling the house. And that was such a headache. I actually ended up making more money on the house, ironically enough, but it was way more of a headache, So my lots, I made 10 and I made like, I think it was like 20 on the house or whatever, but I had to use another wholesaler that I trusted, you know, that also did houses, and they had to do the showing and the whole thing, you know, and
not showing that
a month and a half, whereas the lot closed in like a week and a half. So.
Yeah, I can understand that. Listen, I can't tell people. I like real estate, you know, as a general, and I've tried so many strategies. I can't say one strategy is better than the other. There is nothing about connect what you feel that you're connected to more, right? What do you get excited to? And each one can find his own way. So, but I like the simplicity of this strategy. That's what I like about this.
You know, I'm in love with it myself, so.
Chris, thank you very much for coming to the show.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
All right. Have a nice the rest of the Sunday.
You too. God bless y'all. Be well.
Bye-bye.